There's something outside.
What is that?
Radio.
And this is Julie Wrench, co-host of On the Shoulders of Giants, talking old-timers with Thomas Steinberg, the one, the only. What are you doing, Thomas? How's it been going?
Well, Julie, my age is starting to show. I'm afraid a couple of hikes in the bush recently kind of reminded me I'm not as young as I used to be.
Oh, yeah, I saw some of your pictures that you posted. Beautiful country up there.
Oh, well, we were just down a week ago down in Washington, north of Cougars, Mount St. Helens. It was called the Sasquatch Shindig. It was more of a social event, but we did a lot of research and stuff at night, and there were a couple of possible footprints found that I found rather fascinating. And of course, the morning after I left, apparently something had happened in the camp. I still wonder about it, but I have to point out nothing was actually seen.
Interesting. Well, that was fun nonetheless, right? You got to get out
of
town for a while and see somebody.
Oh, yeah, it was. And it's a beautiful area. That was my first time south of the border since before COVID, since May of 2019. So I really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad you were able to get out. You needed that. Really good. Well, I'll tell you what. We have a special guest tonight that many people have heard of our guest tonight. I'm sure of that. You would have to have been living under a rock to not know this person, okay, in the Bigfoot world. Now, he's been doing research, investigating, interviewing. He even has his own podcast. He started investigating in 1998. He's literally, he's been on Destination America and National Geographic Channel, History, Travel Channel, Discovery. He's just been on all kinds of documentaries about Sasquatch. And he really uses a scientific approach, no nonsense scientific approach to this whole Sasquatch thing. So without further ado, I want to introduce our guest, Mr. Steve Calls, the Sasquatch detective.
Hello, detective.
How are you, Steve?
Good. I'll answer to anything, just not late for supper.
Yeah, I hear you there. Well, we're glad that you could join us on the show tonight, and it's going to be fascinating, I'm sure. But what I wanted to do first was, I know you started investigating back in 1998. You know, it's a long time ago. And what exactly happened that made you want to try to figure out what was going on with this whole Bigfoot thing?
Sure. Well, first, let me say it's a great honor to be on the podcast with the great Tom Steinberg. So, like I said, I've always said that Tom has been one of my heroes since I started getting into this. So,
oh yeah,
hats off to you, Tom, sir. But how I got into this was a friend of mine had said, geez, there's this book about Bigfoot sightings basically in our neighborhood, you know, be it an hour and a half north of us, an hour and a half south of us. And the book covered sightings in the Whitehall area and the sightings in the Columbia County, which is south of us, the Kinderhook region. And the book was entitled Monsters of the Northwoods. It was written by Paul and Robert Bartholomew, Bruce Hallenbeck, and Bill Brann. So that was a good leap off. And being an investigator, a professional investigator, since 1988, mind you, I had training in both the Reed and Wicklander methods of interview and interrogation. I've taken neuro-linguistic behaviors and body language interpretation as well. So I was the kind of guy they would call in to elicit confessions from people they thought were doing, you know, nefarious deeds a lot of times. So I started digging. The first like year was a lot of internet work, and I happened to meet some really good people. One of them being Eric Altman from the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, of course, being the state just to the south of us. You know, so he was a great resource. But then I started hopping into it, following some leads in the books, and then eventually I ended up talking to like 85% of the people that were in the book.
Oh, really?
You know, just to see. And I thought that originally that, you know, I'm going to get into this, and a lot of people are, you know, I was doubting the veracity of it until you actually talk to the folks. That's just my investigator in me. And after speaking to a couple of the police officers and one scientist in particular and a firefighter that had an occurrence actually in the southwestern part of the state, you know, after looking at their reactions, listening to them, listening to how they spoke, I was like, there's something to this. There really is. And the benchmark moment, I think, came in, I want to say 2003, 2002, where I spoke to this one gentleman who was a Vietnam vet. He was in the Marine Corps. And now he was a truck driver for like the last, you know, 20 years. And he lived on this property for 15 years in rural Rensselaer County, New York. And he had found some tracks and had an experience on his property. And I'm watching him retell this thing. And, you know, his breath became very short. His hair was standing up on his arms when he's telling the story. These are things you cannot just, you know, on command do. And looking at the way he told the story and the manner, and he was just reliving the whole thing. And whatever he saw scared him. And this, he was a big dude. I mean, he was probably like 6'2". And, you know, being a Vietnam vet, Marine, no less, you know, and a truck driver, he's been through some scrapes and seen a lot. And for him to have that kind of fear in him, really said a lot to me that, hey, you know what, there is something to this mystery. And that's, you know, going forward. But I always use my investigative toolbox because I felt that you handle this mystery on a case-by-case basis. You never try to lump it together. Just because this person may have misidentified something doesn't mean this person did. Just because this person hoaxed something, this person didn't. So it's always a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, that's actually some good insight, because some people kind of forget that, you know, and they want to lump everything together. They get too cynical about it. You got to be open-minded.
Right. And what that
and
does
I
is
know
it causes,
exactly what you mean about the different reactions a person can have when they're discussing what they saw. And the you know, I've talked to people where their eyes just start watering, and like you said, their breathing changes.
Yep.
So there's always something that intrigues me about those people when I'm interviewing, that it's just so raw to them.
Yep. And the big thing is too is when you start lumping everything together, then you begin something called an agenda. and that's something as a, if you want to be a good investigator, you can't have an agenda. It gives you tunnel vision if you have an agenda and you forget to look at other things.
Mm-hmm. And they call you the Squatch Detective for a reason.
They call me the Squatch Detective because that was actually my first email address I picked up because I was a private detective. I called myself the Squatch Detective.
That's cool. I love that.
My first email address was squatchdetective@yahoo.com. and then I created a free website at the time, and it was Free Yellow. I was using it was squatchdetective.freeyellow.com because I had to tie it into my email address. So eventually in 2005, when I decided to create a more nationalistic website and a paid, and a more professional website and go national, we just called it squatchdetective.com, and that stuck.
Thomas, did you want to jump in here with any questions? Or
absolutely. Hey, Steve, I just wanted to say Steve is one of my heroes now after seeing the way he runs his podcast, and he's a stick-to-the-facts, never-deviate-from-the-facts kind of guy. I just want to clarify, Steve, you basically concentrate in the New York, Vermont area. Is that it?
I have New York, Vermont, sometimes Massachusetts. But I have done investigations in Oregon and in Texas, Oklahoma, Alabama, South Carolina, just to name Wisconsin, just to name a few places I've done investigations over my tenure. But I primarily do investigations out of New York, Vermont, sometimes Massachusetts.
Roger that. You mentioned the book, The Monsters of the North Woods, an excellent book. I still have my autographed copy here. Do you know, is Paul and Bob Bartholomew, William Brown and Bruce Helbig, are they still active? I haven't heard from any of them in quite some time.
Well, I know Paul is. He's very active on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Bartholomew now resides in New Zealand. Excuse me. Bruce is just published a book about the Kinder creature.
Mm-hmm.
And through Small Town Monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill is really the only one that hasn't been very active because of his eyesight. He had degenerative eye disease. And unfortunately, even back as far back as 10 years ago, he wasn't seeing all that great.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Sorry to hear that. And you said you interviewed a number of people that were featured in this book?
Yep, I have. I've talked to Brian Goslin. Primarily the ones that stand out to me is like Brian Goslin, Dan Gordon, Sue Wilson, and another gentleman, which was an anonymous guy. He was actually a field scientist for New York State and had an encounter when he was a young lad. And, obviously I've interviewed Paul and Bill and Bruce. And Bruce himself a witness to a lot of different things going on.
Now, there was a number of incidents in the Whitehall region that seemed to take place over a short period of time, a number of them involving a couple police officers. Were you ever able to talk to them?
Yeah, Brian Goslin
mm-hmm.
Was the one who had the incident on Hebert Road in 1976. And he probably said the most profound thing to me that I've ever heard from a witness was, people keep asking me, why didn't I just shoot it? And he goes, I'm a police officer. It didn't take any threatening action towards me, so I had no right to shoot it. And that made a lot of sense. And Dan Gordon, the late Dan Gordon, he passed away about 5 years ago. He became public in, I then want to say, about 94, 95. He had a heart attack, thought he was going to die, and he decided, I'm going to put this on the record. And so meeting him, and it was kind of funny because I actually sat at a table with them, and this is the first time they really sat together and recounted their stories. And, Brian was telling his, and then Dan, and I've heard Brian tell a story now probably about more than a dozen times, and it's always been consistent, and he always gets, you can tell he gets very emotional about it. But Dan was very emotional about his as well. And when Dan got done telling his encounter, that roadside crossing, him and his partner had had, he turns to Brian and looks at him and he goes, "And I thought you were crazy." which was completely a one in a million in a lifetime moment there.
And in all this time, their stories have stayed consistent. You didn't notice any major differences in what they originally said to what they said to you later?
Not a one. There was not any deviation. In fact, it was very well known at the time. I mean, there was an article that came out before Brian's sighting in the local newspaper there, which is the Glens Falls Post-Star, which is the closest newspaper, let me put it to you that way. And it said, "Officers track creature," and that was the subheadline. And they said, although they didn't really see the creature, they could see it from a distance. They didn't see the creature close up. They could see it from a distance. And that involved three separate police agencies, the New York State Police, the Whitehall Police, and the Washington County Sheriffs. And that was a pretty amazing admission that they said they can only spot the creature from a distance. So they all saw it, but it was way off. But that whole area at the time, between 75 and 76, there was a lot of sightings going on. There was a place in Carver's Falls where a farmer had taken a shot at it, who claimed to have taken a shot at it with a shotgun, and it skedaddled back into the forest. And when the police arrived, they found the shell casing. They actually found the shotgun shell. And there was another one, like the next road up, and of course Carver's Falls Road is off of Hebert Road. There was another road, I don't want to confuse this, but anyway, it was the road up from that. There was witnesses that came out, and they heard their trash cans rumbling, and they put a flashlight out there, and here's this, you know, 8-foot bipedal creature that kind of just turned around and looked at him and then walked off after they shined a light on it. That was doing the rummaging through the garbage cans. So that whole area was having, you know, sighting reports. There was a sighting report on the western side of Hebert Road, off the western side in a cornfield by a farmer. Tracks were found on the Pulteney River, which runs on the backside of Hebert Road, and that's where Carver's Falls, you know, dumps into. Just a whole litany of sighting reports all up and down. And then you move over to Route 4, which is the main thoroughfare. It drives into Vermont. It kind of splits in the village, one to, you know, State Route 22 and State Route 4. And, you know, up and down Route 4 between Vermont and in Whitehall, there have been dozens of roadside crossings that have been reported over the years, including as late as 2019, I want to say.
Okay, so Whitehall has continued with reports, but in this incident, so there was a rash of them in a very short period of time in 1975-76, correct?
Well, I think there has been rashes of sightings. Yeah, that was one of them. But I can, you know, that was where the media kind of focused on it.
Right.
There was a rash of sightings back, I remember, in 2006, where we had sightings off of Hebert Road again, and on the other side of Route 4, down by, not the Geyser Road, it'll come to me, but it was another road that we were seeing, we had basically two separate sightings within a half hour by five separate witnesses. And then we had another sighting like a week later up the road from somebody going into his front yard, seeing one across the road from him on the same strip of, on that same roadway. So there,
all right.
To
the farmer who said he shot at one with a shotgun, do you know if he actually said he actually believed he hit it or not?
I don't really recall, but I believe he may have, he did not say that he hit it. He just took a shot at it, and that's where he left it. So he didn't really, I think he had with the, you know, the O-S-H-I-T moment and like, bang. So,
Okay, so the follow-up investigation by the police found no blood trail or anything like that.
No, they just found, as it was reported in my, and from what Paul can, you know, this is all secondhand from Paul Bartholomew and
right.
Bill, you know, they found a shell casing and that, they or a shotgun, a discharged shotgun shell. And
yeah. Yeah, I'm always fascinated when someone says they've taken a shot at it or shot in its direction because I always think, hey, we may get something here. But
yeah.
always turns out they either didn't hit it or they found no evidence that they hit it. Yeah.
And then again, that was in the, that was in 75, 76 as well. So DNA wasn't even thought of at that point in time for forensic use.
And when did you say was the latest ones you heard of in that area?
There was a roadside crossing in 2019,
mm-hmm.
But there have been reports in and around Whitehall as well that were recent, rather recent. Funny thing is I got one from Saratoga County, which is the county over from Washington County, from 2018, another roadside crossing. And generally when I get reports, it's going to be next month. I'll have a whole slew of new reports because it'll be the Whitehall Sasquatch Festival, which they have now every year. I think this is the fourth or fifth year they've run it in a row.
Okay.
And
now, just to clarify for our listeners, Whitehall, is that the name of a town or is that the name of the county?
That's the name of the town. Whitehall, New York,
right.
is in Washington County, New York.
Washington County, right. Okay. And in your opinion, is Whitehall a little more active than surrounding areas, or are there other small communities that also have continuous incidents reported?
Well, I think it's more observed in the Whitehall area because Whitehall is there's Whitehall, and then it's surrounded by forest, maybe 8 miles, 9 miles to the next nearest little hamlet, which is Fort Ann. And to call Fort Ann a town or a village is like, don't blink. You know, they had to close the zoo because the chicken died. Very, very tiny little community there. But Whitehall has a very interesting geographic feature to it. And that's to the west of Whitehall is the Adirondack State Park, or the beginning of the Adirondack State Park, which wraps around Lake George and continues westward all the way almost out to Buffalo. Whereas on the eastern side of Whitehall is the Green Mountain National Forest. So you have this very strange convergence of that part of the Adirondacks being maple, oak, and birch, which drop their leaves in the fall, versus the Green Mountains, which are deciduous pines, which keep their needles and keep their cover through the wintertime. And it's very interesting. And what I think we've seen, and both Bill and Paul agree with me on that, is that we see this, the reason why Whitehall is such a hot spot, because it's ground zero for their travel between the two forests.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in your opinion, do you notice any particular differences with reported sightings of Sasquatch in your part of the country as compared to, say, British Columbia and the Pacific Northwest of the United States?
No, I think the behaviors exhibited in all the sightings are very consistent throughout both the United States and Canada. I don't see much of a difference in the behaviors exhibited by the creature or what people are seeing. You know, most of the most common behavior being okay, it sees me and it just turns around and walks away, or it's crossing the road. Which makes sense because in a primate habitation model, that's indicative of like a home range activity, and that's where you would basically get your sightings most of the time is through these home ranging activities because they're going from point A to point B.
And in your investigations in Vermont and New York State, have you ever come across any convincing footprint evidence?
Well, yes. In fact, it was kind of funny. There was one area that I had started to in 2000, I got a report from I can say his name now, John Weitzel. And John has since passed away at a very young age. He was in his 40s when he passed away, unfortunately. But John and his wife were in the Adirondack State Park in Fort Ann, New York, which is that community just like 8 miles to the south of Whitehall. And they were walking. They went off trail, and they got down by a stream. And all of a sudden, something started screaming at them. And John described it as something that, you know, vibrated in his chest. And, you know, he had lived up there all his life. He goes, he was familiar with bear and all the other animal sounds up there. And he goes, this was something unlike I've never heard before. It vibrated my chest. So I said, you know, to the wife, I think it's time we get out of here. And as they're leaving, something was following him, and he could see the shadow of it, or the, you know, the shadowy figure kind of like go from tree to tree for a little while. Meanwhile, screaming at them another seven times. And so they got an escort out of the area, basically.
Oh.
And to me, that, you know, that's very representative of how, you know, a primate would deal with a primate of another species in their territory.
Yeah.
We're going to display, we're going to bluff, we're going to make a ruckus, we're going to get them out of there. So to me, that was a natural area to go to.
Okay. Now, based on your observations and your opinion, is there a certain time of the year where sightings are more common, or are they pretty consistent all seasons of the year?
And in our area, the sightings increase from the mid towards the end of July until about mid-December, where they drop off.
Right. Now, your winters are quite brutal there, I know. Do you think the assuming the Sasquatch actually exists and all this is just societal myth and mythology that we keep alive, assuming that the Sasquatch does exist, do you think they are particularly inactive in the wintertime, or is it just there's less human activity in the woods around there in the wintertime, or what is your opinion on that?
Well, like I say, the Aboriginal Homo sapiens had their winter and summer homes. You know, either Native Americans or the First Nations, they had their summer and winter homes. And I think what we're seeing here is, you know, and like I said, in October, the leaves start to drop. So the cover is a lot lighter. You can see further and deeper into the woods, not to mention if it starts to snow, there's no protection of the snow hitting the ground, you know, being caught up in the trees. So I think what we see is this movement generally to and from the Adirondack State Park to the Green Mountain National Forest in the winter months, where those pines will keep some of that snow on top of their, you know, in their limbs versus hitting the ground. So I think and that's our general theory we've run on. And, you know, Paul and Bill and I all agree on that this is something we believe in. And that's the reason why Whitehall is ground zero.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention that pine bark and pine needles also provide sustenance. They do have a caloric and nutritional value as well. So,
do you believe the Sasquatch, assuming that it does exist, is an omnivore?
Has to be.
Yes.
I mean, to maintain that body weight, yeah, they have to be. Mm-hmm. And people have, you know, I remember that old argument, oh, well, you know, there's not enough food in the woods. You know, in fact, it was on my Monster Quest show that I did way back when on the History Channel where, you know, they tried putting out that, there's not enough food source in the woods to provide, provide sustenance for an animal that big. But a bear, a black bear, which we have plenty of in the Adirondacks, has to eat something like 21,000 calories a day for 90 days before hibernation. So if something's eating 21,000 calories, a 4,000 or a 5,000 calorie diet for a Sasquatch should be relatively easy to obtain.
Yeah, obviously people who say there's not enough food in the woods obviously think black bears don't exist either. But, hey, that's just...
Right, yeah. You know, and that's the amazing thing. I remember with the scientist, the one scientist had said that and he was an anthropologist. His name was Philip Stephen from the University of Buffalo. And he was like, well, there's no evidence that suggests that a large primate could exist in North America. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, aren't Homo sapiens a large primate? And then the other one, the one from the Department of New York State Department of Environmental Conversations, made this statement: well, if these things existed, people would be seeing them. I was like, isn't the show what it's about? Is that we're going over about people who've seen these things?
That's too funny.
I remember that show.
Yeah, a lot of people like to put humans in a separate category, but we're not, basically. We're one of the fire primates, you know. The Sasquatch, if it exists, it would be the six. And technically, there's only supposed to be five. You know, human beings, orangutans, chimpanzees, gibbons, and the Sasquatch, assuming it does exist, would be a sixth one. So if we can exist, the Sasquatch can. If black bears can exist in a omnivorous forest, there's no reason a Sasquatch can. I don't think personally there's as many of them as there are black bear, but there could be. Yeah, that's just my opinion. Do you agree with that, Steve, or do you have a different opinion?
Oh, absolutely. I would say probably, you know, there may be a few hundred per state.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're in the thousands in a particular state. I think that's why they may have adapted some of the things, such as tree knocking, to kind of, you know, basically cover an area of miles. That's perhaps even why they may or may not use infrasound, not only for a defensive mechanism, but a communication like the blue whale does. And that's an interesting point of view, too, is that all the large primates from different families of animals, the largest of them have the ability to use infrasound. And if a Sasquatch were to exist, that would make it the largest of the primates. And that generally would lend, credibility that they likely use infrasound.
Okay, you shocked me there. I was under the impression that none of the large apes have infrasound ability.
None of them do. But if a Sasquatch, one of the largest mammals do, like the largest whales, the blue whale can use infrasound. The largest cats, the tigers and lions, can use infrasound. The largest None of the higher primates do, but maybe we're not the largest.
That's a good point.
It was just like, you know, one would expect a coyote. Well, you know, think about it, a wolf can use infrasound. Why can't a coyote? Well, it's not the largest. It just seems like the largest of the family, the families, can use this ability in mammals, and it was very consistent. Which was another amazing thing. It's like, well, you know, the elephant has a family, and I forget exactly what it's related to. Maybe related to like the rhinoceros and stuff like that. But the elephant can use infrasound. So you know, obviously there is. And think about the thickness of their neck, so you can imagine their vocal cords and the howls we hear or we allege. You know, if they can make a chest vibrate, chances are they probably do have that use of infrasound. But and of course, some of the reactions that people get, of course, you know, I take them as, you know, maybe they're anecdotal because they're really not based on anything, but I've experienced it myself. So it's like, I got to lend some credence to it, but not on any type of like factual basis. But my opinion of that is, and it's based on, you know, just pure research data and listening to people talk about their experiences and what they feel. And I think that's a huge thing, too, is that we tend to put emphasis on Bigfoot sightings like UFO sightings, you know, a class A sighting, where you actually see it. That's more important than a class B, which may be a sound or a vocal. But the important thing to remember is in all of this is what's the behavior being exhibited. If you don't hear a Sasquatch and you're starting to get, if you don't see the Sasquatch and you're starting to get a lot of a tremendous vocal and rocks start flying at you, that's a lot more that's a lot more useful information to me as a researcher than somebody seeing one crossing the road. You know, because I know that if they're throwing rocks and using large vocalizations, that's a territorial behavior. In other words, that's where they're hanging out. Whereas one crossing the road is just a happenstance.
Mm-hmm.
And just for our listening audience, if they haven't figured it out by now, you're strictly zoological in your approach to this research, are you?
I'm strictly flesh and blood, yes. Absolutely. Infrasound would also, and the other cool thing is infrasound could also explain some of the more quote-unquote paranormal aspects of a Bigfoot, along with a couple other things like post-traumatic regression and the time it takes for the mind to figure out what it's looking at. So a lot of those things are all logical explanations. You know, somebody said, well, I saw a Bigfoot in front of me and it just, you know, disappeared. You know, either it ran off and you missed it, or, you know, while you were trying to figure it out, it disappeared, or maybe it was such a traumatic event that, you know, you regressed it, the actual remainder of the encounter. That's why people who get, you know, into car accidents, they don't remember the point of impact if they have a head injury, or they, you know, it's not because their brain lost that information. It's because their brain is shutting off to protect that person from remembering the event. Just like a child who's abused sometimes at a very young age forgets that until later in life because their mind is shut it off. And it's a way of protecting the brain, the mind, I should say. And of course, when you see something that's not in your catalog, I mean, the way people see things is that they see these signals, it goes up to the brain interprets it. Well, if it's not in your system, it takes the brain a few seconds to go, what the hell am I looking at?
Yeah.
And, you know, for those who believe in Sasquatch or, you know, have like a researcher that I'm out there looking for this, and you see one, okay, now I understand. But for a person who doesn't believe in it, has never seen one before, never even thinks about it, and there it is in front of them, yeah, they can miss some crucial pieces while that data is trying to be, you know, interpreted. So they lose that second. And, of course, infrasound itself can cause vibrations in the eyes, vibrations in the ears, and it can cause people to believe that they've been mind-spoke to or believe they've been told to get out of the area or, you know, or it could... You know, why did the Bigfoot turn into an orb? It's because you're hallucinating as a result of the infrasound. It can cause all those things. And one of the things I point out, too, is, and I don't know if Tom has seen it, but, you know, Julie and Tom, have you ever seen that movie Paranormal Activity?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you think it was particularly scary?
I thought it was tantalizing. I don't get scared that easily.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, how about Julie? Did you see it?
Well, I thought it was unpredictable. Like, you didn't know it was coming next.
But
you were, on high alert.
Right. But neither – but now, Tom, did you see that in the movie theater or did you see that at home?
Oh, no. I haven't seen it. I haven't gone to a theater in years. I usually
And Julie, did Julie see it on TV, or did you go to the theater to see it?
I saw it in the theater, yeah.
Okay.
When it first came out, the very first
one. Now, we have two different opinions. You thought it was tantalizing, Tom, but you, Julie, thought you were kind of on the edge of your seat, right? And the thing is the theater versions with the sound systems, the director pumped in infrasound. And that's what made it creepier and scarier. That's why people who've seen it at home didn't really think it was scary, but the people in the theaters thought it was scary or kept you on the edge of your seat because you didn't know what was going to happen. It makes you jumpy, right? That's infrasound.
Yeah, what's coming next, you know?
Right, and that was infrasound because the director pumped infrasound into the movie.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, well, I did notice when you did back in the 80s when theaters weren't so ridiculously overpriced, I did go to see the odd film in the theater, and I always noticed that the jump scares seemed to be more effective in the theater than it does watching on a television screen. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, but it's amazing that the director actually used infrasound in a television wouldn't have the ability to spit that out as well as the theater system, which was made to use that sound. And that's why you may have been a little more on edge, not knowing what's going to happen next, going, oh, what's going to happen next? What's going to end? And that's just, right? So then,
right.
You know,
so what you're
really
saying
cool
is if they do have some type of capacity to use infrasound, you wouldn't even know it necessarily. Like, you're not like going, oh, this thing has infrasound. You're feeling a certain way, and you're not sure why.
Correct. Or you're hearing something or you're seeing something. It's not there because of and that was back into a study in the 70s. In fact, when they evacuated the Cuban embassy in a few years back because of the sickness that was going on, they weren't sure if the Cubans or whoever were using infrasound on the embassy or, you know, ultrasonic waves, which are very, very high-pitched. But, infrasound has been weaponized as well. So,
absolutely. They could explain that eerie hair on the back of your neck, standing up, feeling that you're watched. Yeah. But I always point out to people who say that, I felt like I was being watched. I said, anytime you're in the woods, you are always being watched.
Yeah, true. Something's watching
out there watching you.
There's
always
snickers on you.
Probably snickering, too.
Well, Julie, you want to ask Steve about his podcast and how that got going and how he thought of that idea as well?
Yeah, I want to make sure we get that in there before we close out the show in a little bit. I know, Steve, you've been doing the podcast for a long time.
Yep, I've got one of the longest running shows ever on the Bigfoot topic. Started it September 24th in 2006. And we started right here on Blog Talk Radio.
Wow.
And we ran for a number of years, and then finally in 2019 we transitioned to YouTube because we could take advantage of readily now services that provide streaming. And it gave us a whole new forum to show to show videos and pictures. Instead of trying to tell people, just by voice to go here or go there. We can take sound files and put them on our board and have people listen to them and stuff. We just upgraded the technology a bit with the times.
Oh, yeah, that was an awesome show when I was on your show just not long ago. And the name of your podcast is Squatch DTV, and it's found on YouTube.
Yes. Yep. The original podcast was Squatch Detective Radio when we were on Blog Talk Radio. And when we moved over, originally I was going to call it Squatch Detective TV, but I just shortened it to Squatch DTV, almost like a TV station handle.
Okay.
Julie, Steve's podcast is the main reason I finally decided to get into the 21st century computer wise. Because the first time I was ever on his show, I didn't have cameras and Zoom and all that.
Yep.
And I had to phone in, and poor Steve's trying to hold up a cell phone to the mic.
Yep. We did that with Julie.
Yeah, I couldn't. I was just saying, it came off okay.
Yeah, it came off great.
I know what you mean, Thomas, because I can't do the video chat from here because I never know if my internet's going to be working, you know? And so I'm still not in the 21st century myself.
Yeah, it does take a lot of bandwidth, that's for sure.
Yeah, it does. And my internet didn't like it. It
downright got it mad.
Yeah, it freaked out. But now, Steve, you've been doing this show. Now, who is your co-host? Do you have a regular co-host?
Yes, my regular co-host is Chris Bennett. He used to run the Kentucky Bigfoot the Bigfoot Research Project of Kentucky. Met him way back in 2006 or 2007, early 2007. And in 2010, he took over the reins, full-time reins as co-host of the show. So he's been with me 13 of the 17, whatever number of years, 17 years of doing this. You know, he was very uncomfortable at first being on camera because he came on. We were still on Blog Talk for a number of years. That in of itself was a big transition. I didn't mind being in front of the camera. Of course, you know, I'm doing all the TV stuff I've done, so it was fine. But I coaxed him into it, and now he's cool with it, and we're all with it. And we've grown the channel to over 6,400 subscribers now because, of course, when you go to YouTube, you know, you're at a lot of, you know, you're starting fresh. You know, it's not like blog.
Right.
It's not like Blog Talk where we had our followers every time. And you know, there's pros and cons to both platforms. But, you know, the cool thing is that it's paying for itself now, which is a wonderful thing. And because of the numbers, we have a membership where we have an exclusive content area. And, you know, members get some insight into what I'm thinking, although that can I know that probably drives some people to a mental institution. But it's just a neat way. And we're always trying to expand what we're doing. Just this last weekend, I actually did two live streams. I did one day of Hocking Hills for about 3.5 hours, and the second day we did a full 7 hours of live streaming. And people could just watch the street, and every once in a while I would get on there and talk, and you know, spin the camera around and have a guest. And we had a number of guests on day one. Day two we didn't do as many guests, but we had a few. And you know, it was a great experiment. So now we may do that again at the Whitehall Sasquatch Festival and just put it up there so people can take in the sights and sounds of what's going on. And I know at one point on day two of Hocking Hills, there was a Sasquatch going by on a Harley, which is kind of funny.
That's so cool. And it's a win-win, right? The people who are behind the conference or the event, it's good publicity for them. And it's also good because, you know, people become familiar with your podcast that may not have known about it because it's, oh, wow, it's Hocking Hills. I wish I could have went, but I couldn't, so I'm going to check this out. So it's really a cool concept.
Yeah, it was just a thought like the week before. I said, you know what, if I can do it, I will stream and see what happens. I've, you know, we actually did a podcast back in 2019. Or no, not 2021, we did a podcast on an expedition we had because I looked the map up and we had 5G coverage. So I said, you know what, for the show tonight, we're all going to the woods. So I took a couple of, you know, my wife, her best friend, and one of my research partners, Mike Ann, and off we went. And we actually had a very eventful night. We had a single tree knock, which we weren't doing anything really to provoke anything. In fact, but prior to the tree knock, I heard something rather large walking around the woods. And I was like, you know, now, folks, I'm not saying this is a Sasquatch. I don't see it. I don't hear it. And I'm using my phone as a remote feed into the StreamYard thing. And I'm not saying this is a Bigfoot, but there's something large walking around here. And it seems to be getting closer to me. And I don't know if it could be a bear. It could be a moose because we've had moose up on this area, rather recently. So I don't know what it is. So I'm going to ask Mike suit up and come down because I was doing a solo walk down the dirt road. Mike came down and we started, you know, moving forward again. And we started therming because we heard something like a rustle almost. And we started therming and Mike get something very briefly and loses it, and then all of a sudden you hear off in the distance a tree knock.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and we heard it very loud. The recorders didn't pick it up very well. It had to really amplify, but we heard it loud and clear. And like I said, nobody was up there. Nobody. We didn't tree knock to begin with, so why would something tree knock? And the temperature was 48 degrees, so the temperature wasn't cold enough to make give that tree, because when it gets really cold, trees can pop on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But usually that's when it's like, you know, below freezing, and it gets to be like 28, 24 degrees. They start cracking and popping. But that, like I said, it was a 48 degrees at the time. So we end up moving down the road and being caught all live on the podcast. We moved down the road a little bit more. And while we're talking, and this came very clearly over the audio, was a rock coming through the treetops and hitting the ground beside our feet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. And then we eventually put the recorded version that was on our recorders, and it was even louder. You just hear, yeah, it was like, and we just had a rock thrown at us, and I kind of laughed. And of course, my audience's reaction is, wait a minute, you're getting a rock thrown at you, and your reaction is to laugh. Like, yeah, I'm not afraid.
Oh wow! Let me ask you this, Steve. And our listeners would probably are thinking this. Have you actually had a sighting that you believe you saw a Sasquatch?
I've had two sightings. And it's in my primary research area, like I said, in the Adirondack Park. In 2006, I did get a rather good foot casting of that. A year and a half later, another researcher cast a same, we believe it's the same individual, and in fact, because it has the same strange toe deformity, and actually Cliff Berrickman has that, the second cast that was made now, he has that up at the museum, yeah, so I cast one. In fact, that was the first time I smelled one, prior to finding the track. We heard like a groaning and something walking around us from our, you know, 7 o'clock to our 11 o'clock, kind of, you know, around us, but, you know, nearby. And while it was doing that, we could hear the movement, and we got hit with this tremendous smell. And I've been a paramedic before, and I've smelled a dead body that's been around for a week or two. And it smelled like that, but worse. And it had a skunky bit to it, and it had a trash bit to it. So I understand where the skunk ape comes in. I can understand why people would say musk, wet dog, death, garbage, all rolled into one. And as soon as it was there, it had left. So then when we're going out, we actually found the track that had crossed perpendicularly to the trail, about 35 feet away from us. And then we came back the next morning when it was daylight, and we had found the trackway going up the hill and around us and into the woods to where we kind of lost it in the brush. But in 2011, I had my team out in that area doing reconnaissance, and it was about 9 o'clock or so, 9:30 or so, and we recalled the troops to get refreshments, have a little bite to eat, let's debrief, and we'll start out for mission part two. And we're all in the camp, and we're kind of, you know, if you know my personality, I can be cantankerous, and I can be funny.
No.
And, you know, the people around me are like the same. And so I was like, well, my headlamp looks a little dim. I'm going to go out to my car and get some batteries. So I went out to my car on the dirt road, got some batteries, threw them in my pocket, lit up a cigarette, shined my flashlight downhill, which is the north side, which is where at that time a lot of the activity was going on. There was other reports from other people that had sightings down that area. And I spin my flashlight around to the south side, which is uphill, and standing next to your utility pole is an 8-foot, conical shaped, long haired, you know, rather slender, 8-foot tall bipedal creature. And the eyes were reflecting back a very dark orange, not quite red, but not orange. They were very dark. They were darkish. And I could see the damn thing blinking. And after a period of time, I don't know how long, I kind of just froze and kept the light on it. It may have been 100 to 125 feet away, I believe. It's hard to tell. They've actually removed that pole now, so I can't measure it anymore. But anyway, I moved the light, and it walked into the forest to the south side of our camp. And I call out one of my teams who had a videographer, and, like, literally, I was videotaped minutes after my sighting. to explain, you know, and he was like, what did you see? And I'm explaining it. And I was kind of out of it. My eyes were wide open, you know, it's pitch black, and I'm, like, out of it. But while this is all going on, you can hear the camp in the background yelling, hey, we have a lot of movement going on the southwest side of the camp, which is the direction it was headed off into, which in of itself was kind of wild. They eventually, and they caught that on film too, they found the actual cut where it had stepped into the forest, and you could still see dirt, you know, falling into the cut where it had stepped off into the forest from the road. That was sighting number one. Sighting number two was almost a year later in the same area. And we were shooting for Nat Geo at the time. We had traveled all day. It was miserably wet, raining. And we had all, you know, Nat Geo came and said, listen, we're not going out tonight. We're beat. All we want to do is, you know, if you want to do some initial interviews, go ahead. And they did. And they were gone within a couple hours. So we ate something, and we're all around the campfire. It was me, another researcher from Georgia, another researcher, two researchers from Ohio, and we're all kind of just sitting around. And eventually, or you know, one by one, we all kind of pick off and go to bed. So it was maybe about 1:30, 2:30 in the morning, because I wasn't really looking at my watch. But, you know, nature calls. I had to use a tree. So I unzip my tent. As I poke my head out of the tent and I start to climb out, I look off to my left, which is the road. That dirt road, parked in the same spot almost I was, but between the dirt road and where the camp was, here was this 5.5 foot long reddish brown haired thing, and it just bolted off on 2 feet. And my first reaction was I couldn't have just seen that. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, the guy from Georgia goes, hey, you know what? You know, I went out to my car at 11 o'clock to get my pillow and blanket, and I go to put it back, and look what's in behind my vehicle, and it was a birch log.
Oh, yeah.
And what we had been collecting all night during the day, because it had been so wet, was birch, because birch will burn wet because of the oils inside of the bark. And there's this birch log behind her, you know, almost like it's almost like similar to what Ron Moorhead had said about, you know, the gathering of some, you know, they had a hole in the roof of their cabin, how they were collecting, you know, pine branches and stuff to plug up the hole. And the next one morning they got up and they found a pile of pine branches near their camp. That wasn't there. And it was very similar to this. We were grabbing birch all we could, and next thing you know, here's this birch log near our camp that was not there the night before. You know, and just
so
coincidentally
you were being
during
watched for how long, who knows?
Oh, yeah, well, exactly. We were probably being watched during the daytime, because that's when we collected our wood, because then we had to get into camp and set up and do all that fun in the rain, of course. It was, but at nighttime, it had stopped raining. It was a full moon, but it was overcast, so everything had, like, this night light type of glow to it. It was October again, so the leaves have dropped. So, you know, it was very, you got a nice little glow out of the moon, even though it was behind, you know, cloud cover.
That is insane. I don't know that I would just calm about it.
Well, it's the nature of who you are sometimes. And like I was a paramedic. I was a volunteer firefighter for a number of years. I was also a part-time paid firefighter for a number of years. And when you're in the thick of things like that, you know, there isn't much that shakes me or makes me go into a full panic. So, you know, and I grew up in the volunteer. I mean, I was 18, I became a volunteer firefighter. And by 19, I was an EMT. And by 22, I was a paramedic. So it was, you know, you get into circumstances and situations that, you know, I've run into burning buildings where people are running out. And once you do that, you're
right.
You know, there isn't a lot of much that you can be thrown at. You know, maybe the only thing that compares to it is war. Well, it doesn't compare to it. It only exceeds it. This may be war or being in a firefight. But if there's anything more harrowing, it's running into a burning building where you can't see anything.
Right.
Except maybe some, except some clothes, and you're looking for people, or you're trying to put water on it, or whatever. So.
So you have no doubt that these things exist.
I don't now. I know they exist, but I still have to treat each case as an individual basis. It does not change the way I investigate. It does not change the way I think. It only enhances that I know this exists. I want to know if this is a legit report. And if it's horse manure, you know, why would I want to convince myself it's real? Because that would just waste my time. And, you know, time is a precious thing. So.
Right.
I just want to ask before we run out of time, Steve, has your enthusiasm for the subject waned at all from today to when you first started?
No. I've always taken time to refresh here and there, but I still love, you know, if I hear of a report and I'm on it, it's like, yeah, let's go. Let's get this done. Let's figure it out. And it never stops. I'm always looking for the next story. I'm always looking for the next guest. I'm always looking for the next mission. I'm always looking for the next witness. And it doesn't stop.
Well, we certainly appreciate that about you. And I know you've wrote some books. Would you like to tell us, are they still available somewhere?
Yeah, all of them are available on Amazon.com. 50 Large, which is the true story of the Bigfoot body hoax. The second one I wrote was What Would Sasquatch Do?, which is a lot about primate behavior in relation to Bigfoot behavior. And book three was The Sasquatch Playbook, which covers a lot of the different theories on what Bigfoot may or may not be able to do, such as infrasound, eye shine, what causes it, is it a projection or is it a tapetum lucidum, and, you know, stuff of that nature.
Wow. And those are available at Amazon.
And I am writing my fourth book now. I'm only a couple of chapters in, so I don't know when it's going to be ready because I don't rush it. It's going to be called The Psychology of Bigfoot.
Ooh, I like that. Very interesting show. I've learned a lot tonight, Steve, I must tell you.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate that. And like I said, my resources are open to any of anybody that is a legit researcher. My resources are an open book to them. They need me, just drop me a line.
Nice.
And I'm certainly not the end-all be-all. There's a lot I don't know. And, in fact, I probably know less than what I don't know, but at least I try to set myself and other people around me in the right direction.
And it's refreshing because both you and I and Thomas know how wacky it can be in the Bigfoot community with all of
this
woo-ery.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and it's funny, and I'll just make this little editorial comment. I'll be cutting a video probably tomorrow morning. But there was a certain person that came out and tried to say the reason why people don't look like her evidence is because of jealousy and all this other stuff. And they're just jealous. No, it's because it's horse manure. That's why what they're putting out there is horse manure, plain and simple. Telling me that's a Bigfoot, but you know, that's a picture and it doesn't prove anything, and you know, it looks like a modern art masterpiece to me rather than a Bigfoot. Sorry. And you know, when your track is put in front of a scientist who says, you know, hey, this is a human, that's not jealousy, that's a professional opinion by somebody who's seen tracks before. So
Steve, you just keep in mind, anytime you get in a debate with somebody like that, you state the facts, and they don't come back with a counter argument. They basically personally attack or accuse you of something.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, they're defeat, yeah.
You're just jealous. No,
yeah,
I'm jealous. And I always turn around and say, jealous of what? Jealous of what? I've been on TV consistently for... almost 15 years now, 16 years. I've been on hundreds of podcasts. I've been in print. I've been in print in newspapers. I've been quoted in magazine articles. What am I jealous of?
Right.
You know, I've gotten my own cast. I have two of my own sightings. I've gotten to investigate some incredible pieces of evidence or potential evidence. And I've gotten to talk to some great people. What have I got to be jealous of?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
You're just jealous that my standards are not as low as yours.
Well, I think you intimidate people, Steve, whether you mean to or not. I'll just throw that out there.
I just like to say I've been called a lot worse by a lot better people.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Well, what an interesting show, Steve. I'd love to have you back on another time, and maybe we can delve more into certain topics, like the infrasound topic. I'd love to delve more into that because I've had so many people who I've talked to, and you know, they've and myself personally, you know, that the campfire scream sound that you heard that I played on your show, that one vocalization, that sound like it was like right over here to my left and I could feel it go through my chest, that kind of stuff I'm very interested in because I've personally experienced that, and I'd love to know more about how that all works.
Oh yeah, there is so much to this field. I mean, from you know, proper investigation technique to the psychology of a witness to stuff like infrasound and you know, eye shine, the tapetum lucidum versus bioluminescence. Mm-hmm. You know, there's you know, the hair, you know, hair analysis, footprints, and you know, what are the characteristics of a Sasquatch print versus a human print, and you know, because a lot of people that, you know, it's always the argument, oh, well, they're some sort of human. They're us. No, no, they're not. Their feet are you know, orthopedically different than ours. So that indicates that their DNA would be different than ours. And people don't get that. It's that simple. Is that,
yeah,
if they were human, they would look exactly like us. Maybe they have a little more hair, maybe but they don't look anything like us.
Mm-mm.
But that's something called anthropocentrism, where we tend to take animals and give them human-like characteristics.
Hmm. Yeah, we definitely got to have you back on. What do you think, Thomas?
I agree.
Well, Thomas, is there anything else you wanted to add? I see we're a little past the hour here, and
I just want to say to our audience, the Squatch Detective podcast is something you got to check out if you've never checked it out before. Great guests, great conversations, and a lot of stick to the facts and never deviate from the facts. This is exactly the way this kind of investigation should go.
I appreciate that so much from a man of your caliber.
Mm-hmm. And I totally agree.
Yeah,
Steve's the real deal. People aren't familiar with you. They need to get familiar with you because they can learn a lot from your experience. So we really appreciate you coming on the show and taking time out of your, I know, crazy busy schedule.
Yeah, I'm kind of on a downturn right now, just getting back from that conference. I took a couple of days off just to chillax a little bit because that was 2 days of two and a half days of nonstop and you know, 20 hours worth of driving in between, you know, 10 hours
yeah.
each on the bookends. So yeah, I've still been at it behind the scenes a bit yet. So I'm not really taking a break, but just not out there too much until tonight. So.
Well, we really appreciate it, and we hope to have you back on maybe when you get to getting ready to publish that book. We certainly want to get you on to let people know that's coming out.
Absolutely, and I want to thank you guys for having me on. It's always fun talking with you and Tom. It's always been a blast.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, we thank you so much. And Thomas, as always, it's been a great show.
It's been my honor, my lady.
Well, we really appreciate all our listeners. And if you have any questions or comments or what is your email address, Steve, if somebody wanted to try to get a hold of you?
My email address is admin@squatchdetective.com.
Okay. Yeah, and if somebody wants to get a hold of Steve and you're not sure how or, you know, whatever, just get a hold of me, julie.wrench@yahoo.com, and I'd be glad to give you the information. So another great show, and we will be back again. I know we took a little hiatus there. We had some – my partner of 22 years had a triple bypass surgery, so we had to – that was kind of a stressful time, but – he's doing much better now, and the shows can go on. So we'll be back at it. And thank you all for listening.